News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes. If you caught the show last week, you know I was talking to some paratroopers who dropped behind enemy lines on D-Day, June 6, 1944. I got to spend some time with four of them in El Paso. It was a very special visit for me, very inspiring to listen to what these men went through and what it can mean for us today as we prepare for the 68th anniversary of D-Day coming up. If you missed that program, you can find it online. Today, we're going to hear from two more of those paratroopers, including one of the Pathfinders, who had to go in before everybody else to set things up and establish radio beacons to guide the rest of them in. That's part of Beamy Beamisdurfer's story. But first, we'll hear from 87-year-old Angel Romero. Go to KMJNow.com to see what this guy looked like as a young paratrooper. Looks more like a movie star to me. Well, hearing from all these guys who are part of the All Airborne chapter here in El Paso, but you're the only one that's an El Paso native. What was it like growing up in El Paso before World War II?
Super. It was just, I was born there on Chelsea Street, and my dad owned a couple of farms, and we worked all the time. After starting school, then we found out that there was a lot of discrimination, especially high school. I found out then that it was pretty bad, very, very bad, and discrimination.
So as a Hispanic, you didn't feel you were treated the same as the white students in your high school?
Certainly not. There was a lot of discrimination at the time.
And I know it would be different for you in the military, but let me ask you about December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day and how you found out about Pearl Harbor?
At that time, I was a newsboy, and I was delivering the Sunday papers, and the area where I live, very few people had electricity or radios, but I found out there was a bunch of people there in one of the houses where they had a radio, and that's how I found out that they had attacked Pearl Harbor.
Was that a big deal to you?
Not at the time. I didn't understand what was going on. They were talking about, we had heard and we had studied in school, we had been taught about what the problems were coming, but I don't think I had ever heard about Pearl Harbor until that day.
Did it occur to you that this war might be something that you would end up involved in?
No, not at all, because at that time, being, what was it, I was 16, any war would come in, at that time the draft was 21 years old, it would be over by the time I'd be of age.
So what changed? How did you end up in the military?
Well, several things. They lowered the draft age to 20, and they lowered it to 18. I became 18. I waved bye-bye to the family.
Was that hard for you?
Leaving El Paso was very, very hard because my roots were here. I had never been too far away from El Paso, unless we went to visit my dad wherever he was working. It was an entirely new thing to me.
I bet it was hard on your mom.
My mom had passed away 4 days before my 16th birthday. So it was hard on my father because two of my brothers were already in the military and I was the third one. There were still two to follow, so there was five of us in the military at the same time, World War II.
Wow, that's a lot of prayers coming from El Paso for five boys overseas. How did you end up as a paratrooper?
Well, as a kid, where I lived, it was used to be the boondocks. Now it's even the center of town. But there was a plane that was in trouble, and in fact, it landed about a block from where we were, nose down, and we saw the pilot jumping out. And my brother and I went home and took one of my mother's best sheets, and we were jumping off the roof. And both of us became paratroopers.
How high was your roof?
Oh, I'd say about 10, 12 feet.
Did you hurt yourselves at all trying that?
No, not at all.
Well, don't try that at home if you're listening. So was becoming a paratrooper what you thought it would be? Was it exciting for you?
At the outset, it was a challenge, really. But my brother had already gone through the school. He went through the school about 3 months before I did. So I knew that I was going to make it. And at that time, supposedly, it was the toughest military training ever. And my mind was made up that I was going to make it.
Do you think it helped to have a brother going right before you?
Certainly did, yes.
But you guys probably didn't get to serve together in the same outfit, did you?
No, we did not. He served in the 513th, and I was 508.
Did you ever get to see him when you were overseas?
Not him. I saw another one of my brothers, saw him three times, once in England and twice in Germany.
That had to be really special to be so far away from El Paso, but have that little taste of home and that connection.
He wasn't expecting me because we weren't allowed to travel at that time in England. You had to have military travel. But the captain that was in charge of our company asked me if I could arrange it because I had told him that I found out where my brother was, and I said no. He took me with my Class A uniform to the train station with an armed guard, and he went and talked to the train master or something and told him that I had to be at such and such a town, and the train master saw him. He was a captain, so he punched out my travel ticket and I went to see my brother. My brother threw his whatever he was holding when he saw me, or not when he saw me. When he saw me, he didn't know who I was or didn't recognize me. He was surprised. And then he finally said, you know, my nickname. He said, "Eres tú, Helo," you know, in Spanish. Is that you? And yeah. He threw whatever it was. And yes, it was exciting.
So that was one of the glorious moments, but there were some very difficult moments for you too. Tell me about D-Day. How did you experience this day that changed the world?
Well, we had been trained very, very thoroughly. We had been trained technically and physically and mentally, and a lot of emphasis was placed on the mental part. Our day to D-Day started on the 5th of June, and I remember we got up real early and rolling and unrolling the bundles. They were checking to make sure that we weren't overloaded, which we were. Everybody was carrying more than we were supposed to. But in the area where I was, there was an aura of excitement. Finally, you know, let's get it over with. All they needed to do was to get us over there and we'd get it over with. That was our mentality at the time.
And before I forget, I want to hit on something else. You mentioned that in your school here in El Paso that you had felt the sting of discrimination. But I get the sense that in the 82nd Airborne, nobody saw skin color and they treated you the same as anybody else. Is that true?
Well, I felt a little special, actually, when I finally joined the 508, because I was a replacement. I was not with the original 508. I was a replacement before Normandy. When we arrived at the 508, I must have been around 2 o'clock in the morning, so they just assigned us wherever there was an empty cot. That's where I went, wherever they told me. And before I got assigned, or when I was supposed to be assigned, the guys in my squad where I was went to the colonel and asked him if they could keep me in their squad. So that made me feel kind of special. And even today, I still feel special with those guys. And after being in the airborne, I found out that they didn't give a good doodly whether you were whatever. All they expected you to do was to do your job and to do it well.
And you probably wouldn't survive if you didn't. So you said that there was this sense of excitement building, that you guys were ready to get it over with. So where did you jump, and how did that unfold for you?
We were supposed to have jumped in a little town called Saint-Savier-le-Vicomte. We were supposed to capture a bridge there. I wound up landing in a little town called Saint-Martin. We call it St. Martin, they call it San Martin. It's got another name on it, but it was real close to the beach. It would be about 10 to 12 miles from where we were supposed to land.
So what went wrong? Pilot error or disorientation or what?
All of the ones that you mentioned, everything went wrong, and actually everything went right. If we had landed where we were supposed to have landed, they would have annihilated us within 2 days. And as it was, we were confused, but the Germans were more confused because they had no idea how many had jumped. They reported at least 10 airborne divisions had jumped. It was to our advantage that was such a big mix-up.
The confusion worked in your favor. So what kind of conditions did you face, and when did you encounter the enemy?
Very soon after landing, like I said, we were very close to the beach, so just about as soon as we landed, there were some firefights, and there was a lot of running going back and forth. And maybe about 10, 12 minutes after we landed, there were three plane loads from the 101st that landed, almost on top of us. So nobody knew where to go, and there was a labor camp close to where we were, and I could understand some words that were being said in the labor camp. So I started talking in Spanish, and it was very, very difficult. Years later on, I found out that they spoke Catalan, but some words were in Spanish, and I asked them where St. Mary Glees was, and one of them said, way in the back, said, La Iglesia Santa Maria, in Spanish. So I said, yes, and then somebody opened the gate there, and we started talking with them. As much as I could understand, it was very difficult. I couldn't understand much. And they told us which way to St. Mary Glees. I've never been to St. Mary Glees, and I've never been to Saint Xavier Le Vicomte. Never made it.
Sometimes God's plans are a little bit different than the way we or the military envision things working out. Were you scared? Did you feel the ever-present danger around you?
Not before. Like I said, we were trained mentally. And even after landing, I wasn't scared. The first time that I felt any type of fear was whether I could keep up with my comrades or not. That was my biggest fear then. And then, of course, encountering the snipers. They'd fire one shot, and we didn't know where it was coming from. And then it soaked in that you see your first buddy get shot or wounded, and you understand what it's all about. And then you realize that you're in something very, very different.
When was the first time that you were hit?
When it was the first time that I was wounded? It was on the 14th of June in a little town called Etienneville, right at the end of the hedgerows, and I was shot in the leg. We were hedge-hopping each other. We were actually running from the Germans, and there was eight of us, and one would run and the other seven would fire and so on until we got away from them. I don't remember being shot because, like I said, we were running. I remember falling backwards and running. Quite a while later, we were in that little town, in a little church. We sat down, and one of the guys took off all of his equipment, started playing boogie woogie and a piano there. And the guy next to me said, "What happened to your leg?" I said, "Nothing." "Why?" He said, "Look at it." And that's when it hurt. But I hadn't felt anything until then.
You think it was just the degree of mental intensity required to do what you were doing that kept you from feeling that pain?
Probably in part, and probably the excitement that was going on, the fear of getting shot, that we were outnumbered and we were outrunning them. No time to think about anything except survival, I guess. That's part of it.
June 6th is rolling around again, and I'm sure every year it makes you think about a lot of things, but in your mind, what is the significance of June 6th, and what makes you proud to have been a part of it?
My buddies, meeting some of my buddies, knowing now what I know about them and what they know about me. Just this October, I saw one of them. There's two of us left in the squad that I was in. Still, the respect and the love keeps growing.
And what strikes me about all you guys that I've talked to here is Normandy itself would be enough for anyone to survive and endure and deal with everything you went through there. But the war kept going, and you had these other operations that were just as intense, if not worse. What was the most difficult situation you faced? What was the time that you think was most trying for you throughout the war?
I couldn't pick out one. The weather-wise, nothing could equal the Battle of the Bulge. But Normandy was one, like you said, the insecurity, uncertainty of what was going on. In Holland, we got to fight the Germans' best. We got to fight against the Fallschirmjäger. And, of course, the Battle of the Bulge, we encountered quite a bit because we were so outnumbered. And then, like I said, the weather, we weren't equipped for that type of a situation. Our battalion was the ones that stopped the attack going north, so that was pretty bad. Just in our area, in our company area where we stopped them, there were 122 dead SS troops in the company area. And so that might give you an idea of what the intensity of the fight.
No doubt.
Well, we need to step away for a moment, but when we come back, I'll have Angel tell us about the other times he was wounded while serving with the 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 82nd Airborne during World War II. We're going to mark the 68th anniversary of D-Day on Wednesday, and I'll be back with more of Hometown Heroes right after this. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. 87-year-old Angel Romero of El Paso, Texas, has told us about jumping on D-Day, how being dropped at the wrong location maybe even saved his life. And he told us about the first time he was wounded, saying the first time would indicate it's not the last time, right? Well, let's hear about some of the other close calls for Angel in the 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment.
I was wounded in Holland by a couple of grenades, and then in the Battle of the Bosch, I was wounded in an attack. And when we started the counterattack, the 3rd Battalion of the 508th was leading the counterattack for the 82nd, and I was wounded on the 7th of January.
What happened?
On that one, I was wounded by artillery. I was hit by artillery in the back.
Were you evacuated immediately, or did you have to wait around in the snow to be rescued?
I don't know how long I was I was knocked out by what happened. I remember the next thing I remember was a guy from I Company was telling me to start moving or I'd freeze, and another guy was there. A couple of medics on a Trek Jeep came by and put us in the Jeep. They were frozen worse than we were, and but they carried us back and put us in a little cabin. There was a fire there. That was what they, to the medics, the most important thing was to get us to somewhere where it was warm, because in that type of cold, you would freeze in a few minutes.
Well, I'm just trying to imagine what it was like to be in your shoes, and I'm guessing that moment when you come to and you're trying to figure out what happened to you, that's got to be pretty intimidating and pretty scary. What was that like for you?
Actually, you're in a daze. You have absolutely no idea what, or I didn't have any idea what was going on. The first thing that struck me was that I knew the guy that was talking to me from my company. He kept telling me, you better move or you're going to freeze. And it took, I don't know how long it took to realize that something had happened to me. I didn't know at the time what had happened to me. But we did start moving because of him.
And did that end the war for you, or were you able to continue fighting?
No, I was taken out to a field hospital. They had set up a field hospital. I think it was a school. They did some tests on me because I couldn't breathe where the shrapnel didn't penetrate. It just created a couple of big lumps in my back and just a very, very small aperture in the skin. They told me that I would be all right, and I was there, and some nut came by and said that they had stolen a couple of trucks and were going back. They said, just don't get up and go right now because they're watching you. but wait a couple of minutes and the trucks are parked in such and such a place. So I went day well from the hospital and went back to the lines.
So you snuck out of the hospital to get back with your buddies?
Yes. I stayed on until the 508 was relieved at the Roy River. We were relieved in March. We were sent back to an airfield in Drew, France, and the 508 was prepared to jump in case of atrocities. That's where I was when the war ended.
Now, I read an article about you at some point, and I think I saw something that the 23rd Psalm had been of significance to you. What was the story there?
Most of the time, I was the first scout in the company. So being out there, I wore the 23rd Psalm out. You don't hear it too often because I wore it out. I prayed all the time.
Because if you're the first scout, you don't know what's out there. There's going to be enemy around somewhere, and you're about as vulnerable as a soldier can possibly be? Is that what you're saying?
Not really, because as it turned out, I was probably the safest guy in the company. The Germans would allow one or two guys to penetrate, and then they would fire on the main group. My job was that they wouldn't. And according to my buddies, I was very successful. I could detect just about anything. I can't explain what it was, but I could sense a lot of things.
But you certainly felt like you were walking through the valley of the shadow of death at that point, I guess.
Yes, certainly.
When you look back on it all now, when you get together with all these guys, when you think back about everything you went through, the wounds that you suffered that could have ended your life, that didn't, what are you most thankful for?
Probably my life first, of course, and the people I served with. There's no other group. There's nobody else in this world like them.
And just visiting with you guys here and knowing that all of you were wounded multiple times. And I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of veterans. A lot of them were wounded, but most of them they're wounded once, maybe twice. But a lot of you guys wounded three more times. It seems like you guys understand each other more than the rest of us could understand. Is that a sense you get, that being around these guys, they really know what it was like to walk in your shoes?
Yes, especially in the airborne, because we mentioned the divisions, we mentioned the units, we mentioned everything. But really, when you mention airborne, that's the one word.
Even if it's the Screaming Eagles against Double A, huh? Tell me about the rivalry that exists here between the 101st and the 82nd.
Well, the stories go that the 82nd, of course, was the first one to be airborne. And then some of the cadre from the 82nd went to the 101st. So it's always been some of the men in the 101st were 82nd before they were 101st. And there was always that competition. The 82nd, before I joined the 82nd, had already gone into North Africa, Sicily, and Italy. So the pride goes back to a lot of accomplishments. And the rivalry is always who did what, who did when, who, and in reality, we depended on each other.
Absolutely, but you still like to tease each other. So how do you tease them about the Screaming Eagles? What is it that you say to the 101st guys?
What were you screaming for when you were in Bastogne? And it was, help!
And what do they say back to you?
The double A means almost airborne. This is always going on.
Well, is there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you want to share, that you want people to know about you and the guys like you who did what you did all those years ago?
I think that the most important thing is that at the time we were equal. There was no discrimination. When you're suspended by parachute, nobody knows your ethnicity, your creed, your whatever. You're just another person suspended by parachute. I learned to respect every one of the men I served with, and in most cases, I learned to love them. I hope that today's generations look at our service members today and respect them. I respect them.
Well said. Angel Romero, 87 years old. We barely scratched the surface of what he experienced as a paratrooper in World War II. I can't tell you how moving it was to sit there in El Paso with these men and hear them share what they did, what they saw, what they endured.
and to really see that sincerity in their eyes, the depth of what they went through for our sake. Don't forget to go back and listen to last week's show with two other paratroopers who jumped on D-Day. You can find that at kmjnow.com. And now we move on to hear from the man they know in the El Paso area simply as Beamy. Maynard Bemisdorfer is 88 years old. He was a pathfinder with the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 101st Airborne Division. But as we usually do, let's go back to the beginning. So you grew up in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, right next to Hershey. Were you over there getting chocolate bars from Milton Hershey growing up, or what?
I did. During 39 and 40, I worked there as a Hershey had no children of his own. And we were allowed to work there for 4 hours at 35 cents an hour. And the trolley came right from Lebanon to Hershey, which was only 5 miles. And it cost a nickel, and then you got a token to go back. So it cost you a nickel for the round trip. And you got all the candy bars. Anyone was broke at that time, you could fill your bag and take it on home.
That sounds like a pretty good deal.
Well, at that time, I liked chocolate, but I can't take chocolate no more.
Would you have too many D bars in the service?
No, one that went through here later on damaged, and they'd taken part of my intestines out, and it caused colitis, and that just... says I should never try chocolate. Chocolate is like poison to me.
Because of the wounds that you suffered in the war. And that is Pennsylvania Dutch country, and I understand you spoke a little bit of that language?
In our area, to work in the farms, which we lived in the farm, you had to be able to speak Pennsylvania Dutch, which is a broken German, and because otherwise the old farmer guys wouldn't hire you. If you, some different time, like picking the tomatoes or tobacco and stuff like that, you could go from one place to another and make $1 a day. Mm-hmm. And that was good money back in real early times. And when I went to the service, my parents, my dad's side, was of the Mennonite type or the Dunkard type. Mm-hmm. And I was the first one ever to go into the service because they didn't believe in it. And they were surprised when I... said I was going to go in.
They were pacifists and expected you to be a conscientious objector or something?
Well, not necessarily. They knew we were going to have to pull you in sometime. But in our school, we only had 12 boys in our class, and three of them were the real Mennonite type. They didn't have to go. If all the rest of the fellows went either to the Navy, Marines, or Army. And I think there was four of them that were killed.
When did you go in? And what made you think that that was a good place for you?
1939, my parents taking me up to New York to the World's Fair. And they had one of those rides that go up, I don't know, 200 feet or what it was. And it cost a quarter or something like that to ride. And I rode the thing until I didn't have no more dollar. I had a dollar to spend. And I rode it a few times. And boy, I thought that was great. And then... I think it was right after Pearl Harbor, they were advertising that they need troopers, and they were showing pictures on the movies, because we didn't have television, but in the movies they were showing a picture of guys coming down, and it must have been some training, because I don't think after Pearl Harbor there was any paratroopers at that time that I know of, so it must have been some regular jumpers because they had the old leather helmets on.
You went to the movies, you saw that on the newsreel and said, hey, that's for me.
Well, it sounded like a real good deal because being a country boy, living out in the farms, every time we'd go into the city, they would always say, here comes the kickers, because we were, and we had no basketball floor. We had none. We played outside in the open, like a flat top or macadam. Pretty proud to go in there and play on the armory, because that's where we had to play. My mother was very religious and my dad wasn't, because they were two different religions, and it never worked out. But my father would never go to church, and my mother goes all the time, and that's why our whole family was pretty religious.
You get into the military and you want to be a paratrooper. And the fact that you had this language, they heard you speaking Pennsylvania Dutch to somebody and said, hey, we need to put this guy to work?
No, not at that time. I went in for right from Pennsylvania, went right down to Fort Benning. And there we trained across the river there at the Alabama area. And we trained for, I don't know what it was, maybe 2 months or something over there. before we did some jumping. And when we came back, it was pretty rough because they were kind of mean to us. If we didn't do something right, they could knock you down or something like that. And you never said too much about it. We finally got our jumps in, and then the 101st never got there yet. They were still Louisville or somewhere. So I stayed on at Benning for two more months as a dummy jump sergeant, only dummy stripes. And I joined them back in North Carolina at Bragg. About 2 months later, I joined the 101st there then, because they were already going through. And the 501st was the last of the 101st unit, because originally there was a 501 before, but that was a battalion that jumped in Africa, and I think they were mostly all wiped out, if I'm not mistaken. And the 501 was later joined in England with the rest of the 101st unit.
I'm curious, because you'd seen this and you thought you were going to like it. Once you actually got to the business of doing all these jumps, did you enjoy it as much as you thought you were going to?
Yes, I thought it was a lot of fun, especially at nighttime. It was so easy to jump at night. I mean, as long as you didn't hit any tree or anything. But in the Alabama and the Benning area, it was pretty well cleared that you didn't hit too much. You hit watermelon fields and had fun there. Now, when you got up to North Carolina and McCall, there you run into some real tough areas, especially in McCall, because that was a rougher place. When we were there, you knew you were getting ready for something that wasn't going to be pleasant. And then we finally had our airborne maneuvers that was taken off into Tennessee, which was what they called like an all-American units, all infantry, artillery, anything. And they gave you where they land you, they gave you so many days to get to a certain spot. Well, some of the things weren't so sweet there in Tennessee. There were some pretty swampy areas.
So you were feeling like they were preparing you for whatever you're going to deal with.
It wasn't fun anymore jumping. It was it was more scary, and they put more pressure on her because every time we jumped, they put more equipment on you. And then if you didn't bring it back or didn't pack your chute right or bring your or had it messed up, why, sometimes you got hell. It wasn't so nice, because trying to wrap up a chute and put it into a certain area where they were going to pick them up, and if you didn't do it right, they didn't appreciate it too much.
But I imagine once you got to June of 1944, you understood why you had to go through all of that.
I was understanding a little more, because we did some pretty rough training in England, and you asked me a while ago how I got in the Pathfinders. Well, I met my uncle over there, and both being from the country of, like, we mean the cities we were at, and speaking, we sat there and we were speaking Pennsylvania Dutch, and some officer was sitting in back of us, and I didn't know who he was. So he walked around the front after we were done. He says, "Are you Mr. Beemister?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You report to headquarters." I said, "Wonder, I was in trouble a couple of times, but I didn't know what I did wrong this time." And I found out later, they pulled me out of headquarters and they sent us into the pathfinding area. Well, we trained there with the 9th Air Force for quite a while. We weren't allowed to talk to anybody outside that darn fence. And we did a lot of night jumping, and they brought us right back in and kept us in this closed area all the time. So that's how I became a pathfinder.
And for people who aren't familiar, what's the difference between a pathfinder and any other paratrooper in the 101st or 82nd?
There's not that much difference. We had just some, maybe a little bit more sand tables, and we had to learn how to use homing devices and different, we call them the old scarf that we put down as markers. The most of the thing was memory and knew the area we were going in were imposed to be setting up where other fellows were coming in.
Well, and that's what I was getting at. Your job was a little different than theirs, and their jobs in many ways depended on how well you did your job, right?
Well, we think we did our job because we were pretty lucky. There was only a little over 300 of us that trained on the Pathfinders, and we didn't have too bad a plane ride going in like some of these fellows did, because we came in around, and I came down close to Carrington, and it was a little wet there because we came in water.
And I always say June 6th, but for you, it was really June 5th, wasn't it?
We only went in there anywhere from an hour to 3 hours ahead of time. It all depends what unit left the field. And we had to hurry up and set up this stuff and hope we did a good job for it.
I guess so. We're going to talk more about that when we come back with the rest of Beamy's story. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito's, been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common: Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're going to hear about the injuries Beamy Beamisterfer suffered on January 10th, 1945. That, in effect, ended the war for him at the Battle of the Bulge. But before that, let's talk about D-Day, June 6th, 1944. So tell us what your duties were. And were you anxious as you get ready for this big day? I'm sure you're focused on what you're doing. You're not maybe conscious of how massive an operation this is.
We really didn't know what we were getting into for sure. Some of us were pretty darn scared going across. We thought we were super people, but you could see when you looked at some of the guys, they were kind of breaking down a little bit. Our job was to try to set up the best we could for our fellow buddies that were coming in. And then our second job was to hope the engineers that were coming in with a special plane, they had the equipment. There was two dikes that where the bridges were, where that held the water back, and if we couldn't knock those out, that was our second job, to help to show them where these spots were. We were using a new type of material, which I didn't know about, but the stuff was more powerful than we realized. So we had to help them to go in there and set this stuff up. And when they did, they set it off, they set us in the air, because the stuff was that powerful, it just knocked us around.
So the explosion knocked you back, knocked you in the air.
I didn't have no wounds from it. I had bad scratches and cuts, but it affected my ears and my bleeding from my mouth and stuff like that, because the pressure, you just don't realize how much pressure that stuff can do to you and how it throws you around. Then our job was we were right close to Carrington. Carrington was the main headquarters for all the German equipment. We tried to knock it out. I don't know how many times we lost so many men. And what happened after that, American or British command decided it was impossible to take it. So they bombed that place day and night, the English by night and Americans by day. The way they told us, they started from the outside and moved in. And we finally got into Carrington. There was just nothing left of that place. And what happened to the people? We seen a lot of dead Germans laying around, and a lot of cattle and things like that, but we don't know what happened to all the people. We never did find out. But on the 50th anniversary, I was back, and that was the most beautiful city, again, you could ever see. It was all redone, and they had a big museum there, and they had us about maybe 4 hours going through the museum.
So going back there on the 50th anniversary and seeing this city risen from the ashes that you had seen firsthand, what did that mean to you?
It means that people get together, they can rebuild anything. We could tear it down, but they could always rebuild it. But the lives and the men and boys that we lost trying to take the place, I don't know if it was worth it, because today, what do we have? What are we proving today? We're losing boys, coming back with legs off, arms off. We thought we were going to be doing good, but the things are no better today than they were then.
And you talk about the American losses trying to take Carrington. Did you lose some friends there?
I lost most of my friends. On the Pathfinders, out of our 12 that went in with the one group, we lost 8 of them. Because when we landed there, we landed in a little bit of water, and we had to go to another spot because you can't set up equipment in water. We knew the Germans were all around us because there was a big barn that was burning, and we heard this firing over our heads and stuff until later on. It got worse and worse all the time. We knew they were getting close, and if we couldn't depend on our troops that were coming in, we were told our chances of ever coming out would be almost impossible. They all start coming in, and we were mighty happy because they had got stronger, and after many days, they finally taken, as I told you, taken Carrington, what was left of it. We stayed in that area until, I think it was July 14th, they moved us back to England.
When you go in with a group of 12 guys and 8 of them are killed and you're one of the 4 left standing, is it hard not to think I might be next?
As I said, you're scared. Believe it or not, sometimes you don't control your bowels for being so scared. Yes, I was really worried, but I always carried a New Testament in my pocket, which my mother told me to always carry. And if that helped me through, I don't know. But I didn't have no bad cuts or wounds or bullet wounds, but I was cut up pretty bad. And I had concussion, but concussion don't give you a Purple Heart. Later on, back in England, we were given a special award for the ones that went in as Pathfinders. It's the English Wings, just like the three of us received the Canadian Wings, because the Canadians do their jumping here. So we got the gold wings here from Canadians, and I got the gold wings from England. But our training started all over when we got back. I was no longer a Pathfinder then. I moved to a Company H in the 3rd Battalion, and I was moved up in rank a little. Our training started all over, but our groups weren't the same because H Company took a pretty hard licking. And then they brought a lot of fellas in from the States. The kids would ask us, I call them the kids because that's the way it was. Once you were in combat, you thought the others were kids. But they were just as good as we were. Later on, you found out that they were every bit as good in battle as we were.
You were calling them kids, and you were all of about 20, huh?
Yes, I was only a corporal when I went in D-Day. By the time we got to Holland and the Bulge, I was up to the 21 already. Holland was a beautiful jump. It was a Sunday, very smooth coming down, just almost like a jump in the States. But 2 days later, all hell broke loose. And we couldn't depend on the British, because sometimes the British fall asleep and they don't want to listen to what we thought was the right thing to do. In Holland, we had a lot of water to go through because the whole place had a lot of dikes and a lot of banks and stuff. I call them banks to go over. And a couple of places we had to go through some streams with our old boats to find out information, because our group in Holland was mostly trying to get information of what lied ahead, where the Germans were strong, and also some of our American pilots that were shot down, and try to get them back into our area if it was possible.
Were you able to do that?
We did. That's when I got bayoneted. When you go on a reconnaissance like that, you don't use guns. You use your knife and your banjo string. The banjo string was so thin but so strong you couldn't, and had 2 handles on it. And that's what you carried, because you tried to be as quiet as you could. In Holland, it wasn't that cold until later on it started to get a little chilly. It was back and forth, day and night. And you got rest. We had more rest there than we did during the D-Day, because you could come back and you were protected pretty well while others were doing something else.
So how'd you get bayoneted?
We moved into an area. We were sneaking up, and it was a German machine gun area. And this guy I was in the front, and this guy came at me, and I threw backwards, and he put the knife right in my going down through here. I was cut pretty bad, but my buddy in back got him, and the other there was 5 of us on that group, and they got everyone in that thing just by going in there. And we kind of, I say, we butchered them because we were really pissed off.
But it was either you or them.
Yes, that's right, because we weren't no angels. The Germans were dirty, and we were dirty too in a lot of things. And when you think back about it, why, it makes you feel cold, and you lay in bed at night sometimes and you just think what dirty things you did during the war. It wasn't so pleasant.
But it sounds like that day certainly could have been the end for you. You were pretty close.
We put 68 or 70 days, I don't know what it was. We were pretty tired and pretty played out and just plain disgusted, because sometimes things went good, other times it didn't go so good. And they finally relieved us and sent us back to a rest area in northern France there.
What do you think kept you going? Because after what you experienced in Normandy and in Holland, I would imagine it wasn't easy to keep going. What do you think helped you continue on and keep fighting the way you did?
I honestly don't know. I just did what the other fellows did, and by that time I was a sergeant and I was supposed to watch over some of the younger guys that they brought in, and I tried to tell them what to do or where the bad spots were or what to look out for. I guess that's what kept us going.
And what happened to you at the Bulge?
Oh, I don't want to talk about that. D-Day was bad and Holland was bad, but the Bulge was worse than the two put together. It was hell. They threw us in there in trucks. Some of us didn't have the right equipment, and some didn't have the right guns and equipment. And the only thing that saved a lot of us, as we were marching in, I think it was the 103rd or the 106th, I'm not sure it was, that was already defeated, and they were coming back, and they were handing out their food, their guns and everything, and the guys were picking them up. And that's what helped us to get a lot of supplies that we didn't have. I really don't know for sure if it was the 103rd that we were told that the Germans were machine gunning these young kids that were never in battle before. That just made us so mad that, well, we did some real bad things, but we did our best. We couldn't take prisoners anymore, because every time we did, there was no place to put them, and we found out that we would lose a man or two. So we had some orders. I don't know if they were makeup orders or what, but not to take prisoners, and that's a terrible thing to do.
And when and where were you wounded?
Well, that was wounded. In the beginning of it, I was hit in the side, but not that much. I was stitched up and kept on going. But on January 10th, we were moving up. It was across a little pond, and there was two tanks on top of the hill. They didn't have no gas, so they couldn't move, but they had plenty of ammo. So we did get the one by the fellas crawling up and burning the sides out, but for somehow or another, we weren't smart enough, and they got us. And I never knew what hit me, but I found out 2 or 3 days later I was in a hospital. How I got there, I don't know. But I know it was in some kind of a tent, and there was all, I couldn't move anything except my hand. Couldn't move my legs, and this was completely shot out. Later on, they put us in a box cars and sent us back to Paris. And then I only found out that not only the men got shot up, but there was a nurse. It was laying on, all these boxcars had a bunk here and another bunk here. And the nurse underneath me had her both legs cut off. And that there hurt me more than seeing some of our fellows. Because without our nurses, most of us wouldn't be here today. To me, that was one of the hardest things I could see. I mean, she was saying that, telling us different things. And she could talk pretty good. And we listened, because she said that on the tent, some shell came in through and caught her, the doctors, and that's all she would tell us about. So from then on, from Paris to England, back to Boston, to Atlantic City. Atlantic City was a big hospital area during the Second World War where they treated, and there you were waited until you were in good enough shape to be sent to the main place, like Bob was sent to here. And I was sent to Pickett General, and that was a big med. And I spent, I think it was 9 months down there. That was the end of my career. I couldn't go no further, and I was just lucky that by some good doctors and stuff, they got me to able to walk again.
Did you ever, in 9 months recovering, did you ever have days where you didn't think you were going to walk again?
I had some bad days, because when they sew nerves together in your arms and stuff like that, it's the most painful thing you can ever go through. I didn't know, but they did have some good doctors and some good treatments, and that's the first time since I was back on the farm that I was able to ride a horse, because they put you on a horse and walk you around the areas to get your I guess to get your blood circulation working a little better.
Even before you could walk, you're riding a horse.
Oh, yes. And then they put you on, there's long places with bars where they hold your shoulders and you walk back and forth in like a treadmill. And they, while they're doing that, the doctors shoot some kind of liquid into your legs to take the pain away. And after a while, you start moving your legs okay.
You can look back now. If you didn't survive that, you never would have met your wife. You guys just celebrated your 65th anniversary.
And we were neighbors from little kids on up. We knew each other real good because she always come down to our house to play with my sister, but I didn't care for her because I was years older than her. And I used to tell my sister to get that kid out of here while we're eating. And so it went on like that, but we always were trying to send letters back and forth during the war. And when we finally came home, we got together because her parents were strictly religious people. We got together and they never thought the devil of the neighborhood could marry a religious girl like she was, because I was pretty bad when I was a kid.
And you're still together today, and I know you're thankful for that. How do you account for all that, for the close calls that you had, the wounds that you suffered that I know there are still lingering effects of today? Why do you think you got to survive and have the life that you've had?
I think that little book that I carried in my pocket to help me, because that's the only thing I know, and somebody somewhere looked over us. Bullets would fly all around and hit one of your friends, but why it missed you, I don't know. You can't tell that. They say you're not scared. I was scared many a times. Sometimes you would go for a long time during the bulge, especially with hardly anything to eat, and so cold that I heard some of the fellas say, I hope that next bullet's for me. It was really bad. There's no way to explain the bulge. Everything was against you.
Well, I know you've told your story many times, but why do you think it's important for people to know what you and what all those guys who didn't come home, what they went through and what World War II was all about? What's the biggest thing you want us to understand today?
I wish some people would understand. There's some people think Hitler didn't do some of the things that he did. In fact, we had a major in our outfit here, and he insisted that Germany didn't do some of those things. When I hear that from a man that was a great guy, I thought he was a great man, but he had a belief that a lot of people have today, that he didn't do those things to the Jews. He didn't only do it to the Jews, he did it to some of the Catholic people too. He was just a crazy man. Well, I'd like to say more about what we have leading us today, but I don't want to get into that.
What you can say, I'm sure, I would imagine that you feel some pride in having been a part of the effort and in leaving some of yourself over there in the effort to defeat Hitler. Is that something that gives you pride today?
Well, I'm proud of what we did. The 82nd and the 101st lost a lot of men, fought hard, in the belief that we knew we were doing the right thing. And that's the best thing I can tell you.
Well, it means so much coming from someone who has been through what you've been through. Thanks to Beamy Beamensdurfer, Angel Romero, and the other two paratroopers you heard last week, Bob Chisholm and Art Johnson. What a special group of guys there in El Paso. When Wednesday rolls around with the 68th anniversary of D-Day, remember what these gentlemen did on that fateful day and throughout the rest of the war. That's the program today. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes on KMJ.